Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Did I put the clothes in the dryer? I hope they don't think I was serious
about that. I need
to be
awake. Next.
I forgot my brain shut off.
Just sleep already.
When your racing thoughts keep you up at night, it's tough to let go and get the rest you need. Better sleep can help. You might have heard of white or brown noise, but there's a whole rainbow of color noises, and they can help you calm your mind, reduce stress, and sleep better, like the green noise you're listening to now. With the Better Sleep app, you can discover more color noises and over 200 soothing sounds, guided meditations, and bedtime stories. High-quality rest is vital to your mental well-being and physical health. Calm your restless mind, conquer your day, and sleep better at night. Download Better Sleep from the App Store or Google Play and start a 7-day trial today. Because when you sleep better, you feel better.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams, whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Don't overestimate yourself, but don't underestimate who you could be. That's a much better way of thinking about it. You know, psychologists of the careless sort, I would say, have been pushing the idea of self-esteem for a very long time, probably since the early 60s. You should be content with yourself the way you are. It's like, no, you shouldn't. Seriously, like, you're nowhere near what you could be. You're not even close. Right, and so that's a way more optimistic message. Like it's, you ain't seen nothing yet. That's the right message. And so I would say, don't overestimate yourself now, but don't underestimate your future self. And you have so much influence as an individual if you get your act together that you can't believe it. There isn't anything that has more influence than that. You have all the power that there is right where you are to put things right around you. You start now, you develop a noble vision, right, of who you could be. You start to put that into practice, develop some discipline, familiarize yourself with the great works of the past. Learn to read, learn to write, learn to speak, learn to think. Man, you'll be deadly. What you could bring to the table that hasn't been brought to the table for years is an emphasis on individual responsibility. And the right way to do that, as far as I'm concerned, is to start with yourselves, is develop a vision for your life. You start to think about, if you could be who you could be, what would that look like? That's the beginning of a mature philosophy of being. If you could be the person that you would admire, who would that person be? How would you configure yourself? How would you configure your career, your education, your family, your the use of time outside of work? If you wanted to be the noblest person that you could be, who was adopting the maximal amount of responsibility, how would that look? Then you need a strategy to put that into place. And that's the way you change things properly, and also the way you do the least amount of harm while you're changing them. And so it should be an individual focused set of ideas, and that way you can sidestep the identity politics traps, and that would be a very good thing. And I think a modern conservatism, which isn't really all that distinguishable from a classical liberalism as it turns out, is to put tremendous stress on the responsibility of the individual. And one of the things that's wonderful about that, as far as I'm concerned, and I made reference to this a few minutes ago, is that you need a meaning to offset the tragedy of life. Otherwise, you just suffer stupidly, and you tend to make people around you suffer the same way. The way that you find that meaning is by adopting as much responsibility as you can. And what's also so fascinating about that is, you know, you're characterized by an indefinite potential. it isn't easy to understand exactly what that is, that potential. But you know, it's what people call you on when they say, you know, you're not living up to your potential, whatever that is. That potential will be called forth from you as a consequence of adoption of responsibility, because it won't manifest itself unless you take on a load. You're not going to develop in all the ways you could develop unless you set yourself a serious challenge, because it takes the challenge to pull that out of you and also to motivate you to rid yourself of all the weaknesses and personality flaws that you've accumulated across the years and to let those disappear and burn off you. You need to load yourself up before the demands of life will be such that you will discipline yourself properly. And a noble goal is a very good way of beginning that. The truth of the matter is, as far as I'm concerned, that each of us has enough potential character, power of character, let's say, if it's properly manifested, to contend with that in a noble way and to rise above it and to transcend and to deal with it in large part, because we can make the world a much better place than it is for each of us individually and for our families and for our community. And we can constrain the malevolence, at least in our own hearts, and perhaps have a positive effect on those around us as a consequence. And that actually does make things better, and we actually can do that. And that's where the meaning in life is to be found. And that meaning, you know, that goes along with the adoption of that kind of responsibility is actually the antidote to the suffering. You know that perfectly well, because all of you need a reason to get out of bed in the morning, especially on a rough morning, you know, when things aren't going so well in your life. And there will be plenty of times when things aren't going so well in your life, and you still need a reason to get up and get moving and get out there. And if you have adopted the responsibility at an individual level to make things better, given how bad they are, if you've adopted the responsibility to make things better, then you have a reason to get up. And so one of the things that I've been stressing to people is that there's very little difference between the meaning in life that gives you fulfillment and that engages you in existence and the willingness to shoulder it.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
As much individual responsibility as you can possibly handle. Those are the same things. And that's a really useful thing to know. And you kind of know this, right? Everybody knows this because, first of all, if you're not living up to your responsibilities, even to take care of yourself, the probability that you're going to be ashamed of that at some level is extraordinarily high. And so your own soul tells you that you're in error, so to speak. But also, if you look at who you spontaneously admire, which is a good indication of where your value system really sits, you'll see that the people you admire are always people who take responsibility for themselves and responsibility for their family and responsibility for their community. Get your act together. You've got things to do in the world. The absence of your full being in the world leaves a hole that is filled by terrible things. At minimum, you have an ethical responsibility to ensure that the world doesn't devolve into something approximating hell. And at maximum, you have the responsibility, again, the ethical, and it's a heavy ethical responsibility, to do everything that's in your power to make things as good as you can possibly make them in this sophisticated manner that takes you and your family and your community into account. And it's on you, right? And that's meaning. You know, people say, well, I'd like to have a meaningful life. It's like, well, fair enough. But the price that you pay for the meaning that transcends tragedy is the adoption of responsibility for the catastrophe of existence. But that ennobles you, right? It makes you into someone strong and someone competent and someone who's worthwhile and who lives in a manner that justifies their own suffering. And that's what There's nothing better than you could possibly do than that. Although there is a very large number of ways of looking at the world, or perhaps a near infinite number of ways of looking at the world, there isn't a near infinite number of ways of acting in the world in a manner that actually is successful. So there are constraints on how you can interact with the world in a successful manner. Let's assume that you don't want undue pain and anxiety. We could just start with that, and I think that's a reasonable proposition. You could tolerate some pain and anxiety if it's in the service of something greater, obviously, but I just mean pointless pain and anxiety. We don't want any more of that than is necessary. And that means that you have to take care of yourself to some degree. But the manner in which you take care of yourself is severely constrained. This is partly why you have to be intelligent and careful and plot your way through life properly. You have to take care of yourself today, but you have to take care of yourself in a way that doesn't interfere with you taking care of yourself tomorrow, and next week, and next month, and next year, and 5 years from now, and 10 years from now. So you can't do just what you want to in the next hour. Because if it's impulsive, pleasure-seeking, let's say, something like that, excess alcohol use or excess drug use or careless sexual behavior or betrayal of people to gain you something in the moment, you're going to pay for that. You're going to pay for it tomorrow. You're going to pay for it next week and next month and next year. So because you're going to exist in the future and because you have to live with yourself, there's only a certain number of ways that you can act that are going to work. But it's more than that. It's not just that you're responsible to your future self or the set of all your future selves, is that you also have to act in a way that works for your family, because otherwise your family is going to disintegrate and break down and cause you and them all sorts of misery and grief, and not just your family now, but also your family into the future, and then not just your family either, but also your community. And so you have to set your aspirations so that they serve you in the broadest sense over a long period of time, and they also serve your family and they also serve your community. And that's a very tight set of constraints. And I think that the best solution to that set of constraints from a philosophical perspective, or maybe even a theological perspective, is to view the world as a place not of groups but of individuals, of sovereign individuals who are responsible for their destinies, responsible for their families and for their communities. You learn to use minimal necessary force. It's like you don't defend yourself any more than you have to. Like, be careful. Don't push any harder than you need to, because all you do is you generate a counterforce by pushing harder than you need to, and then you're in conflict. And you think, well, I like a little conflict. It's like, look, fair enough, a little conflict, man, no problem. It keeps your life kind of interesting, and maybe that's on the problem-solving edge. But a little conflict can become a lot of conflict very, very rapidly, and if you have any sense at all, that's not what you want. You know, especially if you have other things that are better to do, and you should have other things that are better to do.
18-year-old kids, one sentence, what would you say to them? What's the restorative, the redemptive sentence? What should they do?
Don't be thinking your ambition is corrupt. You know, because that's part of the message now. Human beings, we're a cancer on the planet. We're headed for an environmental apocalypse. The entire historical structure is nothing but atrocity, et cetera, et cetera. Anyone with any ethical aim whatsoever is just going to pull back. You don't want to manifest any ambition, support the patriarchal structure, exploit the environment. You got to crush yourself down. You shouldn't even have any children. It's like, no, there's no excuse for that. There's zero excuse for that. I saw a professor at an event, something like this. He came out and trumpeted this bloody environmentally friendly house he'd built. And, you know, fair enough, man. It was a pretty interesting house, but not everybody had the $4 million that it took him to build it. And I'm not criticizing his money even. It's like, he's had some money. Good for him. He built a house. Okay. But then to trumpet that as a moral virtue, well, you're pushing it there. And then he came out to all the kids and he said, you know, my wife and I decided that we were only going to have one child. And I think that's one of the most ethical things we could have possibly done. And I would strongly encourage you to do the same. I thought, you son of a you get up in front of these young people. A lot of these kids were children of first-generation immigrants from China. And he showed all these images, you know, of these terrible factories in China, these endless rows of sterile mechanism that were subordinating all the Chinese people to this terrible, you know, capitalist
machine. And I thought, you don't understand. Half the audience is looking at those factories and thinking, that's a hell of a lot better than struggling through the mud under Mao, buddy. And so, I don't know where he thought he was, but to come out in front of all those kids and basically tell them that the whole human enterprise is so goddamn corrupt that the best thing they could possibly do is limit their multiplication, and to think of himself as a scholar and an educator. I did say something, by the way. It was rather uncomfortable, and he stomped off the stage. But that's no message for young people. There's no excuse for that. And you think, we're going to destroy the planet. We have to do this. We have to demoralize the youth to be ethical. It's like, yeah, really, that's your theory? You're going to demoralize young people to be ethical? That's your theory? It's like, you should go home and think about that for like a year. And I'm passionate about this, you know, because you have no idea how many people that's killing. You have no idea. I see people everywhere, all over the world, they're so demoralized, especially young people, especially young people with a conscience, because they've been told since they were little that there's nothing to them but corruption and power. It's like, how the hell do you expect them to react? If you orient yourself ethically in the most fundamental sense, then in some sense you have the force of God on your side, and then maybe you can prevail despite the difficulty. And I think that's right. I think that's true. So, and you can ask yourself, I try to ask these questions seriously, you know, and I would also say that I've been driven to my religious belief, such as it is, by necessity, not by desire. What do you want to have on your side when you're contending with the unknowable future and its vagaries? How about truth? How about beauty? How about justice? You want allies? Those are powerful allies. People have to act as ethically as they are powerful. And so I've been trying to convince people to do that, I suppose, or to put forward, not to convince them precisely, but to put forward an argument about why that's necessary and why it's on them. It's like, no, this is on you. You got to understand this problem, it's you. You don't get it right, it isn't going to work. And so how do you do that? Well, you start with what you have under control in your own life, because where else are you going to start? You look to yourself, put your house in order. Don't be worried about some other person walking the satanic path. And that's what activists do all the time, right? It's you. It's the corporations. Like, it's someone else. No, no. It's you. And I think that's also fundamental to the Judeo-Christian doctrine, is that it's you. It's on you. Redemption's an individual matter. And so my hope is that if enough people take themselves with enough seriousness, then we won't end up in hell. Because we certainly could. It's a high probability. And so, and I also don't think that you can be motivated enough to put your house in order to the degree that's necessary merely by being attracted, let's say, to the potential utopia that might emerge as a consequence of that. So that'd be a vision of heaven, let's say. No, you need to also be terrified of hell. Think, well, there's no such thing. It's like, just because you haven't been there doesn't mean there's no such thing. It's like, you have to be pretty bloody naive to think there's no such thing. Like, how much evidence do you need? And how does it come about? Well, it comes about at least in partial consequence of the sins of men. And I think that's true. So I go around and I talk to people. I say, look, there's not only more to you than you know, there's more to you than you can imagine. You have an ethical responsibility to act in that light. And you might claim not to believe that, but I would say, well, your whole culture is predicated on that belief. And insofar as you are an active member of that culture and a believer in its structure, then you believe it. You might not be very good at believing it. You might be full of conflict and doubt, and you might not be able to articulate it, but it's still right at the bedrock of your culture, this notion of what? The divine sovereign individual. Is that not what your culture is predicated on, that idea? The logos inherent in each person? It's something other than that? I've never seen a credible argument made to show that it's anything other than that. You know, you can say, well, rights are attributed to you by the state. It's like, sorry, that's a weak argument, because the state's dependent on your actions. So, you know, to believe that, you have to believe that the state is the entity. and that individuals are just subordinate in some fundamental sense to the state. It's like, no, the state is dependent on the individual to exactly the same degree. So we're the active agent of the state in some sense. We're the seeing eye of the state, the speaking mouth of the state, because the state's dead without the individuals that compose it.
C.S. Lewis, if I swallow the scientific cosmology as a whole, meaning only all that exists is what we can perceive through our senses, then not only can I not fit in religion, I cannot even fit in science. If minds are wholly dependent on brains, and brains on biochemistry, and biochemistry in the long run on the meaningless flux of the atoms, I cannot understand how the thought of minds should have any more significance than the sound of the wind in the trees. You feel that one as well.
Yeah, well, that's a complicated problem. That, first of all, I do believe that I don't think science is possible outside of an encompassing Judeo-Christian ethic. So, for example, I don't think you can be a scientist without believing, as an axiom of faith, that truth will set you free, or that will set us free. So we don't know the conditions under which science is possible, you know, and we tend to overestimate its epistemological potency. It's only been around, I mean, you can stretch it back to the Greeks if you're inclined, but in a formal sense, it's only been around for about five centuries, and it's only thrived for a very short period of time, and it's perfectly reasonable to assume that there were particular preconditions that made its rise and ascendancy possible.
It is a historical phenomenon.
Yes.
It happened at a specific moment in time.
Right, and for and at least
so
in principle for
conditions?
Particular reasons. Yeah,
got
and I think
okay.
One of the conditions, well, there's a bunch of them. One is, for example, there's an intense insistence in the Christian tradition that the mind of God in some sense is knowable.
Yes.
So we could say, well, the structure of the cosmos, and you have to believe that that's the case before you're going to embark on a scientific endeavor. You have to believe that there's some relationship between logos, logic, let's say, but logos is a much broader concept than logic, that's for sure. You have to believe that there's some relationship between that and the structure of the cosmos. You have to believe that the pursuit of truth is in itself an ethical good, because why would you otherwise bother? You have to believe that there is such a thing as an ethical good. And those are not scientific questions, which is why I think the arguments of people like Hitchens are weak. It's like, yeah, Hitchens, Dawkins, people like that, they have a metaphysic which they don't know, and they assume that metaphysic is self-evident. It's like, well, sorry guys, it's actually not self-evident. And they assume that it can be derived from the observations of empirical reality, and the answer to that is no, there's going to be axioms of your perceptual system that aren't derivable from the contents of your perceptual system. And you might think, well, that's not very scientific, and I would say, well, take it up with Roger Penrose and see what he thinks. Because I just talked to him for like 3 hours partly about this topic, about, say, the role of consciousness and the structure of consciousness. And it's by no means obvious that the materialist reductionists have the correct theory about the nature of consciousness. And not surprisingly, it's like we don't understand the relationship between consciousness and being at all. The conditions of human life are such that suffering is an integral part of existence. Life is suffering. Why? Well, one reason is because of society's arbitrary judgment. Every single one of us has traits and features and quirks and idiosyncrasies that are far from ideal and that are judged by the standards of society as insufficient. And so you suffer because of your imperfect insufficiency in the eyes of others. And you can certainly make the claim that fairly frequently that's arbitrary. And so that's the claim that society is tyrannical and judgmental and needs to be constantly reconstituted so that the tyrannical element doesn't take full control. And fair enough, you have to stay awake so that that doesn't happen. But the thing is, it doesn't matter what society it is, although they vary in the degree of their tyranny. The mere fact that you're grouped together with other people and have to come up with a common value structure in order to live together means that many of the things that characterize you are going to be suboptimal. And so the price you pay for social being is that much of you is deemed insufficient.
Now, hopefully, there are various ways that you can be within a society that's sufficiently diverse so that you can find a place where what's good about you in the eyes of others and perhaps in your own eyes can flourish of its own accord. Because you don't have to be good at everything. If you can be good at one thing well enough, that might allow you your niche. And hopefully, a healthy society allows for that. Certainly, societies can become so tyrannical that they don't. The other element of it, clearly, is the mere fact of the arbitrariness of the natural world. You have a lifespan that's going to be counted in the number of decades that you can count on two hands. And that has nothing to do, technically, with the tyranny of the social structure. Now, you could say, if we got our act together more completely, perhaps you could live longer, and fair enough. But the fact of the limits of your lifespan and the suffering that's necessarily a consequence of that, the death of your parents and the death of most people that you will know before you, means that that part of suffering is an integral part of existence itself. And so that can't be laid at the feet of an insufficient social structure except insofar as it's tyrannical and blind. It's a condition of existence. And then by the same token, you have your own responsibility for some of your unnecessary suffering, because there's things you could be doing to make your life better and to make life better for other people that you know perfectly well that you're not doing. So there's three reasons why you suffer, and one is, well, look at you and the way you're built. It's inevitable. There's not very much of you and there's a lot of everything else. And so you just don't last that long and you're fragile across multiple domains. And then you're harshly treated by society and there's no doubt about that. And then there's responsibility that can be laid at your own feet. The proper pathway through that is to adopt the mode of authentic being. And that is something like refusing to participate in the lie, in deception and the lie, to orient your speech as much as you can towards the truth, and to take responsibility for your own life and perhaps also for the lives of other people. And there's something about that that's meaningful and responsible and noble, but also serves to mitigate the very suffering that produces, say, the nihilism or the flee into the arms of totalitarians to begin with. You need something to shelter you against your own vulnerability. And you can adopt a comprehensive description of reality that's formulated for you by someone else that neatly divides the world into those who are innocent and perhaps innocent victims and those who are guilty and perhaps the perpetrators of the suffering. But none of that has anything to do with you. And in addition, it's not a reasonable way of assessing the world. The suffering is built in. The existentialist take is, no, that's just how it is. That's just how it is. You don't have to necessarily have done anything wrong for things to get completely out of control. It's a terrifying doctrine, but it's not a hopeless doctrine because it still says that there's a way forward. There's a pathway forward, and the pathway forward is to adopt a mode of being that has some nobility so that you can tolerate yourself and perhaps even have some respect for yourself as someone who's capable of standing up in the face of that terrible vulnerability and suffering, and that the pathway forward, as far as the existentialists are concerned, is by, well, certainly by the avoidance of deceit, particularly in language, but also by the adoption of responsibility for the conditions of existence and some attempt on your part to actually rectify them. And the thing that's so interesting about that is, well, two, as far as I'm concerned, and some of this is from clinical experience, you know, if you take people and you expose them voluntarily to things that they are avoiding and are afraid of, you know, that they know they need to overcome in order to meet their goals, their self-defined goals, if you can teach people to stand up in the face of the things they're afraid of, they get stronger. And you don't know what the upper limits to that are, because you might ask yourself, like, if for 10 years, if you didn't avoid doing what you knew you needed to do, by your own definitions, right, within the value structure that you've created to the degree that you've done that, what would you be like? Well, you know, there are remarkable people who come into the world from time to time, and there are people who do find out over decades-long periods what they could be like if they were who they were, if they said, if they spoke their being forward. And they get stronger and stronger and stronger. And we don't know the limits to that. We do not know the limits to that. And so you could say, well, in part, perhaps the reason that you're suffering unbearably can be left at your feet, because you're not everything you could be, and you know it. And of course, that's a terrible thing to admit, and it's a terrible thing to consider, but there's real promise in it, right? Because it means that perhaps there's another way that you could look at the world, another way that you could act in the world. So what it would reflect back to you would be much better than what it reflects back to you now. And then the second part of that is, well, imagine that many people did that, because we've done a lot as human beings. We've done a lot of remarkable things. I often ask undergraduates how many hours a day you waste or how many hours a week you waste. And the classic answer is something like 4 to 6 hours a day. You know, inefficient studying, watching things on YouTube that not only do you not want to watch, that you don't even care about, that make you feel horrible about watching after you're done. That's probably 4 hours right there. You know, you think, well, that's 20, 25 hours a week. It's 100 hours a month. That's 2.5 full work weeks. It's half a year of work weeks per year. And if your time is worth $20 an hour, which is a radical underestimate, it's probably more like 50 if you think about it in terms of deferred wages. If you're wasting 20 hours a week, you're wasting $50,000 a year. And you are doing that right now. And it's because you're young, wasting $50,000 a year is a way bigger catastrophe than it would be for me to waste it, because I'm not going to last nearly as long. And so if your life isn't everything it could be, you could ask yourself, well, what would happen if you just stopped wasting the opportunities that are in front of you?
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
With Robinhood, not only can you trade individual stocks and ETFs, you can also seamlessly buy and sell crypto at low costs. Trade all in one place. Get started now on Robinhood.
Trading crypto involves significant risk. Crypto trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Crypto LLC. Robinhood Crypto is licensed to engage in virtual currency business activity by the New York State Department of Financial Services. Crypto held through Robinhood Crypto is not FDIC insured or SIPC protected. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Securities trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Financial LLC, member SIPC, a registered broker dealer.